This is a coastal story, written and presented by Charlie Connolly. In the mid-afternoon of the 29th of January 1917, Annie McIntyre, a 17-year-old housemaid at the Shandon Hydropathic Hotel, was returning from an errand and walking along the shore of the Gare Loch, about half a mile from her workplace. It was an unusually calm day for January, but the light was starting to fade when she heard a shout coming from the loch. In the gloaming, she could make out two men splashing and struggling in the water, 100 yards or so from the shore. Annie turned to run for help, but as she did so, she saw first one and then the other slip beneath the surface. By the time she could raise the alarm, there was no sign of anyone in the water, not even a boat from which they could have fallen. "You must have been mistaken," they told Annie. "It was seals, maybe, or porpoises. Just a trick of the light. Even a young girl's overactive imagination." Annie bit her lip. She was sure she'd seen them. She'd heard one of them shout, saw their arms waving. She walked on to the hydro, frowning to herself. K-13 was a remarkable vessel. A steam-powered submarine, 330 feet long, displacing 2,600 tons of water and requiring a crew of 60, this was one of the largest underwater vessels of the age. Launched at the Fairfield shipyard in Govan in November 1916, K-13 completed a successful trial submersion at Gare Loch, a sea lock on the Firth of Clyde, on the 20th of January 1917, and was all but ready for deployment in the war with Germany. On the 29th of January, K-13 was back at Gare Loch, undertaking her acceptance trial, the last stage before going into service with the Navy. The vessel, with the smallest crew necessary to operate it, descended to 80 feet and stayed submerged for 2 hours, allowing non-essential personnel and a few dignitaries to enjoy a leisurely lunch at the hydro. While K-13 did enough to pass the trial, engineers reported the boiler room had grown very hot during the submersion, too hot to allow an examination of its ventilators. To be on the safe side, it was decided another short dive should be made, no more than 15 minutes or so, just to ensure that absolutely everything was working as it should. This time, everyone in attendance boarded the submarine for the brief, final, just to make sure, extra test. 80 people, all told, crew, Admiralty officials, and a few assorted dignitaries and hangers-on. Conditions were perfect. It was high tide, there was not a breath of wind, and the water was pond calm, the only ripples being the wake of the tender, the Comet, as it chugged back to the pier at Shandon, having embarked everyone needing to travel onto the submarine. Once the hatches were closed, Lieutenant Commander Godfrey Herbert gave the order to dive, and K-13 slipped gracefully beneath the glassy surface of the water. Also on the lock that day was another submarine undergoing trials, the E-50. And when crew members out on deck watched K-13 descend, they thought something didn't seem quite right. When any submarine submerges, there are obviously a few bubbles. But K-13 seemed to leave a trail of far more escaping air than there should have been. The captain ordered a buoy to be dropped where the submarine had dived, and went ashore to make further inquiries. On board K-13, it was clear almost as soon as the vessel submerged that something was wrong. She was descending far quicker than she ought to be, so quickly that passengers and crew were soon pressing their hands to their ears to try and ease the searing pain caused by the fast pressure change. Blowing the ballast tanks made no difference. The vessel's controls were getting no response. The submarine was sinking. As the watertight doors all along the K-13 were quickly sealed, a crewman reported seawater pouring into the engine room. Four ventilators, each 3 feet across, had been left open, allowing gallons and gallons of seawater to rush in. With such force, it even rocketed along the voice communication tubes, turning them effectively into hoses throughout the submarine, one jet of water shorting out the switchboard. Additionally, more than 30 men were now sealed inside the part of the submarine that was flooding. Barely a minute after the order had been given to dive, the K-13 scraped onto the gravel at the bottom of the lock, listing to port, bow slightly raised. If the speed of the accident had any benefit, the submarine was still relatively close to the shore, and hence barely 60 feet down. To the people on board, those 60 feet might as well have been 60 miles. The men on the submarine spent a difficult night. As oxygen levels dropped, their energy sagged accordingly. The following morning, a struck match would give off smoke, but there wasn't enough air to produce a flame. At 8 o'clock in the morning, diving boots were heard on the deck, and there was a banging on the hull. The men couldn't even raise a cheer by then, but answered with some listless banging of their own, enough to tell the diver there were survivors on board. The diver himself nearly drowned. The suit he'd been given hadn't been used in so long that it burst open as he ascended. In the meantime, the two senior officers on board, Herbert and Francis Goodhart, who commanded a similar submarine and had come to observe, decided to attempt to reach the surface using the conning tower as an airlock through some ingenious use of the upper and lower hatches. Herbert made it out and up to the surface, but Goodhart was knocked unconscious before leaving the submarine. His body was found later, trapped in the wheelhouse. Up above, Herbert was able to coordinate the rescue, having vital information on which parts of the submarine were flooded and where the survivors were gathered. An airline was lowered and attached, preventing the passengers from suffocating and allowing the ballast tanks to be blown again, lifting the front of the vessel enough that its nose broke the surface and could be supported by barges on either side. Welders were able to burn through the hull, the sparks and the blue light casting eerie shadows on the hopeful faces of those gathered below, who had now been trapped for more than 2 days, watching the outline develop of what would become their route to safety. The square of grey scudding sky they could see when the hole was opened was suddenly the most beautiful thing they'd ever seen. A miracle. The breeze that blew in across their faces was the most marvellous thing they had ever felt in their lives. And one by one, the men were lifted out onto the hull and transferred by tender to the Shandon Hydro. A head count revealed 32 men missing, stranded at the swamped end of the vessel when the watertight doors were closed. Commander Goodhart, of course, had drowned in the wheelhouse, attempting to get to the surface and summon help. Of the 32 missing men, only 30 bodies were recovered from the submarine. Two were missing. John Steele, a foreman engineer from the Fairfield shipyard, and Arthur Lane, an engineer on the submarine's crew. Both had been in the engine room when the flood was discovered, and the rescue diver had reported the engine hatch as being open. Steele and Lane had managed to force it and make for the surface. They were the two men Annie McIntyre had seen struggling in the water on the afternoon the submarine had gone down. The change in pressure as they'd risen quickly to the surface had been too much for them, knocking them out before they could reach safety. Lane's body was found in the River Clyde 2 months later. Steele's was never recovered. The submarine was raised and repaired and still went into service 9 months later under the name K-22. No other naval vessel has ever been allocated the number 13 since. That was a coastal story. I'm Charlie Connolly. Now you might remember that in January of this year we lost the extraordinary Toby Carr, a man I was lucky enough to call a friend after we met through his project to kayak through all the areas of the shipping forecast. Well, this Saturday, June the 25th, Toby's ashes will be cast adrift in the sea off Cornwall, allowing him to drift with the tides and rise and fall with the waves forevermore. There's going to be a flotilla of kayaks attending the ceremony off St. Anthony Head near Falmouth, with people unable to attend being asked to do something to remember Toby at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I'll put more details in the show notes. But if you can, this Saturday, 25th of June, at 1 o'clock, please at least cast your eyes towards the sea and pause a moment to remember an extraordinary person. Maybe tune into the shipping forecast. He'd love that. The world is worse off without Toby's presence in it somewhere, but with every shipping forecast, there's a little bit of Toby still out there in the world.